West. Our program calls for electric cars. We can't have the Americans pulling an end run on us.
End run?
I will speak with Jane Scanwell. She can handle the American industrialists.
Still blinking with confusion about Malik's Americanism, Sibuti asked, What about Japan?
Yamagata is being very cooperative. Not only has he pledged his corporation's assistance, he has even volunteered to form a steering committee that will serve as liaison between the major multinationals and our council.
Very good. But what of the Big Seven? Malik's eyes narrowed.
The confiscation of Astro Manufacturing had its desired effect on them. They have all fallen neatly into line and permitted us to install our own administrators to manage them for the length of the emergency.
That could be 10 or 20 years, said Sibuti, the beginnings of a smile on his thin lips.
Or more, agreed Malik.
The older man rocked back in his desk chair for a few moments. Then, hunching forward again,
I still believe we must face the very urgent need to inform the public about this. It is imperative.
In time, Malik said placatingly.
In time. Look at what happened when we informed the leaders of the environmental movement.
A disaster, Sibuti agreed. Under a promise of secrecy, a dozen of the world's leading environmentalists had been brought to Paris and briefed on the greenhouse cliff. The GEC wanted their help in formulating plans for recruiting environmentalists all over the world to help in the battle against the impending catastrophe. What they got instead was chaos, suspicion, and distrust. Three of the prominent European Greens flatly refused to believe the data before their eyes. Several of the Americans expressed the opinion that the GEC could not solve the problem, and one actually seemed to believe that a worldwide flood would be a good thing, as if the world deserved such a cataclysm.
We must control this news very carefully, Malik was saying. Very tight control of the media is absolutely necessary.
But you don't seem to understand, Sibuti countered, that the news is already leaking out. The politicians we have briefed, the environmentalists, they will not keep our secret. Not for very long, at any rate.
Nodding, Malik admitted, I know. That is why our next move must be to gain a firm control over the news media worldwide. Once that is accomplished, then we can begin to break the story to the public in our own way, on our own terms.
Sibuti nodded back. Ah, I see. Yes, that is the way to do it, I suppose. It shouldn't be too difficult to gain control of the media in most nations. Even in Great Britain, the government can censor the news whenever it feels the necessity.
It's the Americans who will be the problem, as usual, said Malik. Them and their quaint notions of freedom of the press.
There are the international news networks as well.
Yes, but they can be handled the same way we got the cooperation of the Big Seven. A little show of force and a plea for voluntary cooperation. Or else.
A formidable task, said Sibuti.
But it must be done.
Yes, I agree. I shall place it high on our agenda for next week's meeting.
Good.
The Russian got to his feet. Sibuti rose too and extended his hand. The two men left on a much friendlier note than they had displayed earlier. But as Malik strode back toward his own office, he thought, Let the old fool prepare his agendas and chair his meetings as long as he stays out of my way. I've got it all almost within my grasp. Once the news media are under control, then I'll have the power I need to get this job underway.
Sibuti sank back into his desk chair once Malik left his office. His thoughts were not on next week's agenda, but on his nephew in Jakarta. His nephew owned a small construction company that was bidding on a major project to construct a seawall meant to protect the Indonesian capital against the rising sea level. Sibuti had discreetly funneled much information to his nephew, helping him to prepare his bid for the project.
Now my nephew wants me to put in a personal word for him. All I have to do is call the contracting officer and suggest, ever so mildly, that the Indonesian project should go to a local firm.
He stared at his phone console, its screen blank. The seawall will be useless, he knew, if the greenhouse cliff raised sea levels more than 10 meters. Moreover, his nephew had complained that he was being forced to pay an exorbitant priority fee to an outfit of thugs who controlled the concrete business in Jakarta. Rumors were that they were associated with some international crime syndicate. Rumors again. Sibuti saw his own reflection scowling in the dark phone screen. Do I want my nephew mixed up with such criminals? Yet how can he remain in the construction business without access to concrete? Does it really matter? Write off their excess fees as a cost of doing business. Everyone else does. But should I personally intervene? It is not proper. Yet, he is my nephew. Sibuti stared at the phone console for a long time, struggling with his conscience. Finally, he reached for the handset, thinking, blood is thicker than rules and regulations. After all, he is my nephew. And everyone does it. If I don't help him, someone else will help one of his relatives.
28. It had almost come to a fistfight, but finally Dan and Tucker convinced Big George that his beard had to come off. Dan did the honors, sitting George on the toilet in his lavatory and chopping away for what seemed, even to Dan, like hours. Tucker was almost climbing the walls when Dan straightened up, his back popping with strain. Want me to shave the stubble for you, George?
I can do it myself,
the big Australian muttered, sullen and subdued. Dan stepped back into the office. Tucker jabbed an impatient finger at the pile of hair clippings on the floor.
You don't have to be Sherlock goddamn Holmes to figure what you guys have been doing.
With a grin, Dan said, that's what the cleaning robots are for. They ought to be popping in here pretty soon. Usually come into this office around 1 a.m., unless Kate's reprogrammed them. Tucker growled,
like you were in here that late to see what time they arrived.
I burned some midnight oil in this office, Dan said, glancing around. All of a sudden, he hated the paintings on the walls, the slightly odd feel of the desk chair. This has been stolen from me, he said to himself. They've stolen this office, the furniture, the whole company, everything I have.
Well, I hope you two are fucking satisfied.
Dan whirled to admire Big George's freshly shaved face, and understood immediately why the oversized Aussie had grown the beard in the first place. George had a baby's pink, smooth face, wildly out of joint with his massive physique.
How the hell old are you, George? Dan asked.
23, mumbled the Aussie. Holy shit, said Tucker. I must have been 23 once, but it was so damn long ago I forget what it was like.
Laughing, Dan went back to his former desk.
Now what?
Tucker fairly screamed. I just realized, Dan said, flicking on the computer again, that if I can get into the company's system, I can also get into some of the personal files I buried in here years ago. If nobody... Aha! There it is. He looked up at his two friends, beaming. Fellas, we may have been fugitives when we came in here, but we're going to leave like gentlemen. Just to be on the cautious side, however, Dan told Tucker and George to leave by the back door the same way they had come in. I'm going out the front door, just like I own the joint.
Where do we meet up again? Tucker asked.
At the registration desk of the new Yamagata Hotel.
What? Are you crazy?
Like an owl. Give me half an hour. Then come to the registration desk and ask for Roger Wilcox. That'll be me. I just pulled up Roger's old file, transferred some of the money he had left in the bank, Earthside, and made him a reservation at the Yamagata. Top flight suite. You'll enjoy it.
He's fucking nuts, said George.
You got a better place to squat? Dan snapped. They'll have all the tempos staked out by now, don't you think? Certainly all the airlocks will be under close surveillance. Tucker shook his head wearily.
You're right, Georgie. He's nuts. But he's right, too. By now, we couldn't get out of the city unless we had a platoon of U.S. Marines with us.
Dan flipped him a military salute. See you in half an hour. There was a human clerk at the registration desk, even at half past midnight. That's how posh a hotel the Yamagata was. He was Japanese, of course, much too polite, actually, to ask where in the world Mr. Roger Wilcox was coming from. There were no passenger flights arriving at this time of the early morning,
and Mr. Wilcox had no luggage.